Lowe's has all the supplies you need to get your home spring ready, inside and out. Shop Ego, the number one rated brand in cordless outdoor power. Plus, renew for the season with select cleaning essentials for under $10. Our best lineup is here at Lowe's. Lowe's, we help you save. While supplies last, selection varies by location.
Visit your nearby Lowe's on Silver Drive in Columbus.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the History Hotline podcast. I'm your host, Yana Lynn Cook, and today I'm joined by a really, really special guest. I'm really excited to welcome Hannah Francis onto the podcast. Welcome, Hannah.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Oh, it's so good to have you here. I've known Hannah through things like YHP, the Young Historians Project, and through her work. I've seen her on social media doing her thing for quite a while now, so it's a real pleasure to have her. I'm gonna read your bio first, introduce you properly, just so that people know who we are dealing with today. Hannah Francis is a researcher and historian with interdisciplinary interests in gender, race, education, and emotional well-being. They're a volunteer at the Young Historians Project, supporting the Community Education Research Group, as well as the wider organisation, to work to uncover previously hidden elements, stories and narratives within Black British history. They're also a member of the History Matters group, helping with journal submissions and editing. They graduated with a first class bachelor's in history, literature and culture from the University of Brighton in 2020 and went on to receive a distinction in the MRes History of Africa and the African Diaspora in 2021 at the University of Chichester under the supervision of Professor Hakeem Adi. She has gone on to become a researcher in their day job and contributed a chapter to Many Struggles, New Histories of African and Caribbean People in Britain on the Black Parents Movement, which was published in July 2023. She's also a member of Black and Brown Rainbow, which is a peer-led anti-violence organisation dedicated to ending violence against Black and Brown LGBTQI plus people. So welcome, Hannah, to the podcast.
Thanks. What an intro.
No, honestly, the work you've done and have been doing and continue to do is actually fantastic and brilliant, and across such a wide kind of forum of spaces, whether it's academic or in kind of charity and community work. And yeah, it's just a pleasure to have you here, really. So thank you.
Thank you.
Then we'll start with some quick fire questions, as we tend to do. And one of my questions was going to be essentially, why did you decide to start to study history? And I've noticed that you did history, literature and culture as your undergrad degree. And I didn't know you studied literature as well. Love that for us. But why did you pick that course then? Why, I guess, with a focus on history, but why also literature and culture as well?
I think it all started at school, really. Like, I really enjoyed history at school, even though we were like rarely taught about Black history, let alone Black British history. Like during the time I lived in my family home. But I also enjoyed, I really enjoyed like English literature. I really enjoyed like a lot of African-American kind of literature. That's kind of my introduction to it. And then I kind of got a bit more into like Black British literature. So I really liked that for undergrad, the University of Brighton offered this kind of like interdisciplinary sort of take on history, literature and culture, I guess. But yeah, I think I really loved history at school, but I grew up like in a particularly white sort of area, you know, a very small market town like in the southeast of England, in a pretty high earning like middle class household. My parents didn't really have like access to wealth growing up, but my sister and I did. And I think materially our childhood was comfortable, but we experienced like a mad amount of racism. You know, we were in a particularly white, right-wing, very classist and hostile place. So at a young age, like that kind of prevalence of racism was something I was like hyper aware of. So I think there was like, oh God, like 75 Black people in the 2011 census, and that's only jumped up like 90 now in 2023. Like, it's nuts.
In the whole like town?
In the whole town. So like currently less than 1% of the population of my hometown is Black. And only like 281 people are mixed, and they don't even like
define
what mixed means. So hometown was not good vibes. Like, our local MP was like Damien Hines, who, you know, the kind of guy who rates Amber Rudd, who was behind the entire Windrush scandal, for example.
Yeah,
who totally votes outside of the interests of, you know, racialized people, people seeking refuge or asylum here, you know. So bad vibes town. So I think if I had to pin it to like a particular moment, it's probably when growing up, like really young actually, I was keen to like maybe study history. I think I wanted to study it to sort of not only know myself and like sort of the importance of community and support, but sort of just reflect on the own privileges that I had growing up, I guess. I think sort of those experiences of racism and like, yeah, those experiences of racism, I think I knew I had to adopt more of a collectivist mindset. And I think history was a means for me to be able to do that.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and the collectivist mindset and the idea of that has kind of shone through even within the bio that we read out, like YHP, it's very much a collective organisation. The Black and Brown Rainbow as well, like all these collective groups that kind of work instead of pitting people to be like exceptional on their own, working within a collective, within those that you find community in to reach these goals, or, you know, to campaign or to do the work that would make society a little bit better, kind of, it's really shone through. I'm happy you brought that up about kind of seeing the importance of collectivism as well. You said you like started with kind of African-American literature and studies and history and that kind of thing, and I think most people that grew up in Britain unfortunately are only kind of exposure to anything that dealt with race was literally African-American issues and civil rights or slavery if you went there. I remember for me it was like studying To Kill a Mockingbird in English at school for GCSE,
was like one of my fave books.
I don't know though, to this day, is it actually like an exceptional, is it a great book, do I actually love that book, or was that the moment where I actually got to talk about race and talk about some of the things that were in my brain and I was speaking about at home in a classroom in an academic setting. And I'd be keen to know if I like, I've got it on my shelf and I always mean to reread it and I haven't done it because I'm scared that I actually won't actually like it. Like, and it was just the moment, you know. And that's even growing up in, well, I went to school in Handsworth, which was obviously very multicultural. My school wasn't that much multicultural, but, or like, what's the bell word? I don't like the word multicultural. I feel like Margaret Thatcher trying to push out this like agenda, a political agenda. But no, even going to a school that had, you know, a more of a mixed population than, let's say, yours, with less than 1% Black people in the whole town, let alone your school, it was still, an interesting kind of experience. But keeping with our quickfire questions, what would you say was your favorite historical time period, let's say, to study now? And obviously now you've done a master's in research and you've taken your studies further than African-American high school curriculum.
It's true. I mean, I feel like a lot of people might say this, but I love a bit of 20th century Black British history. Woo-hoo. Like, just think in conjunction with like the history of the breakdown of the British Empire, I think it's a really important period that I don't think our state, our nation state, Britain, doesn't do it justice. I think we so often hear stories of Windrush relayed to us and stories of arrival of like migrant workers from former colonies, and like people across the African and Asian continents, as well as Caribbean islands. It's kind of always relayed as a story of like rebuilding Britain after the war, and that immigrants were essentially invited to live and work here, and Britain is positioned and sort of like in our nation's collective memory as an almost neutral, like paternal force, as opposed to like this colonial giant that completely exploited the land and people of ex and present colonies, including our families, you know. And I think, you know, as a person like being of Jamaican heritage who was born in Britain, I think it's absurd that, you know, Britain decides to tell us what our history is and how it should be remembered. So I think studying specifically Black British history in the 20th century and that kind of radical activity that was happening there, and not only in like the 60s and the 70s as well, like pretty early on stuff, like 1930s, like responses to like the invasion of Ethiopia, for example, by Italy, like in the 30s, and the diaspora coming together here specifically. I think it's just such an impressive century for us and for members of the diaspora that I think Britain underplays our role in it, definitely.
Absolutely. And I feel like they do that to protect themselves. Absolutely. Well, I don't even know if it does that, because it just clearly highlights what we're not being taught. Mm-hmm. Who would you say then is your favourite historical figure, maybe within that time period or another time?
I think I'd probably say it's Claudia Jones. I think, you know, she was such a dedicated feminist. She was communist, rejecting the exploitation of black women as workers, like in the home, in wider society. You know, she was kind of like, she was in essence like a proto, like intersectional feminist in a way. She was laying a lot of the framework and the groundwork for what our understanding of intersectionality is today. You know, and it didn't, like, her work didn't stop despite the amount of hardship that she went through. Like, even when she was deported to the UK, she literally founded two newspapers or magazines, right? Like West Indian Gazette and I think like Afro-Asian News or something, you know. And I think, you know, she's part of a body of women who's subscribed to like overlapping and complementing sort of politics like communism, Marxism, Leninism, Pan-Africanism, but their interpretations of that differs. But yeah, I think Claudia Jones is definitely one of them. And I think probably someone else, maybe lesser known.
Let's do someone lesser known as well.
I think who was pretty key specifically to 20th century black history was Elma Francois. She was super active in Trinidad. She's actually originally from St. Vincent. She was born in there in 1897, but she moved to Trinidad with her family, I believe, in sort of the early part of the 20th century. And she was a working class black woman, and she went on to do really amazing things. Like, she founded the Negro Welfare, Culture and Social Association, and they helped her organize like hunger marches for like sugar workers' rights in the 30s. And like spurred on like national response to the Italian invasion of Ethiopia in 1935. Like, she was really doing bits. And I think she has gone probably underdocumented, might be the word I'd go for. I think, who wrote the book on her? I think it was Rhoda Ruddock or Reddick.
Rhoda Ruddock,
Legend. It's a small book, but it's packed just full of the things that Elma Francois did, and I don't think people realise the impact that she had, in the early 20th century. So yeah, probably those two.
Definitely. I like that. And I think you made an interesting point as well, that the early 20th century is quite under-spoken about. Is that even a word? But we are in a place where I think we've been, and the more I think about it, and maybe I've played into this as well with like past episodes and the kind of history I do, being like post 1948, we've been fed this really sanitized Windrush narrative. And like, I like to think we're at a place now where we're pushing back against it a little bit and actually interrogating what Windrush means. Why have they fed us this term Windrush? Why are we using that? Why not, you know, something else? Why is this story coming to the forefront with regards to the scandal and things like that? Like, how is the state manipulating these narratives for us, making it palatable for them to look a certain way because they let all these black people into the country and they contributed so nicely to the society of Britain? Wow, and now they're all old people and living happily here. No, we all know the real story. But as you said, like, having that aside, understanding the work that came before them is so important. Mentioning Elma Francois, Claudia Jones as well. We don't really think of her as like Windrush generation because she was deported here and did a lot of the work that kind of seems to lay the ground for that, what the Windrush generation are known for, stuff like Carnival. So yeah, it's really interesting and I think important that you mentioned that kind of early 20th century as well as everything that happened after 1948 as well. Definitely. So I feel like we're getting to know you quite well, Hannah, and I wanted to ask you a little bit about the History Matters Journal. And I think you'll know if you've listened to this podcast before that we do episodes with the editorial team of the History Matters Journal to promote the work that they're doing. It's really interesting and important work. It's another medium to podcast in. It's a journal, it's written, it's easily accessible, it's free, it's online. No excuses, really. But you are part of the team. And I wondered, you know, how did you become a member or part of that team? Why did you decide to kind of get involved with the work that was going on over there?
So I wrote an article for History Matters. I think it was in 2020.
Yeah.
Might have been in a 2021 publication. I can't quite remember now.
Yeah.
It was before I'd actually joined, and I wrote this article then when I just completed my MRes. I was working in a university at the time, sort of like my first full-time job, like outside of education, that is.
Yeah.
Sort of like supporting young people, like with their mental health in a small university. And I was also working part-time, like in supported living and stuff. So I was just like, oh God, like, I don't know what to do with my life or what to do next and things. And it was kind of around a similar time as well that a couple of friends of mine, we actually founded like a local YCL branch, a young Communist League branch in Brighton and East Sussex. And I actually had really little writing experience before this, like outside of uni. So I think when I completed my master's degree and I was kind of getting a bit more involved with some friends and in some kind of like local politics and stuff, you know, I had a meeting with Professor Addy and History Matters member A.S. Francis, who you know very well. They met with me to discuss writing an article, and I joined the group later in 2021. It was actually really nice because like even when I was working in that university and like when I was a support worker, like my previous bosses would like let me do my work, like not even on my lunch breaks, like in my downtime. So yeah. You know, like even though some of my workplaces weren't the most diverse of places, like my specific sort of teams
were
really supportive of the kind of stuff that was going on locally and the kind of stuff on like a broader scale nationally, like what people were doing to contribute to these kinds of histories and stuff. So yeah, like my first article was on, it was on a woman called Jackie Berkeley. And this was actually like some extra research that I had that I hadn't written too much about in my thesis, which was on the Black Parents Movement, which was how I later developed that chapter for Many Struggles. But we can talk about that later. It's in your hands.
I've got it. I've got the book.
Love it. So my first article was some extra research I had left over from that on a young woman, a young West Indian woman. She's 20 years old. She was unemployed at the time. She's called Jackie Berkeley. And she was sexually assaulted and arrested by members of the Greater Manchester Police Force in 1984. Basically, she was caught up like in a street disturbance one evening. She wasn't really involved. I think maybe like one of her pals was like chatting to someone. Like, basically, it wasn't that deep, and they targeted her. And she was targeted by both male and female police officers. And all officers involved were actually found to have covered up evidence and falsified statements during the entirety of the trial. But she was still sentenced to like, I think, 2 weeks imprisonment due to breaching of the peace. I say with air quotes, because what does that even mean? So the reason why this is connected to the Black Parents Movement is because the Black Parents Movement, they're actually key to instigating and supporting a campaign in her defence. But devastatingly, it was a really, really tough case. And because of what she had experienced, she had actually attempted to take her own life. And it was kind of what sparked my interest in sort of like how these kind of violent structures can really, really rock the well-being of people, but specifically Black women as well. And this was actually reported in an issue of Race Today in May 1985, I think it was. So while she survived that attempt on her life, you know, the case proved that the police, DPP, magistrate, they'd done all they needed to do, basically just issue a guilty verdict upon another innocent Black woman, you know. And it was a horrendous thing that I came across, but I was like, I feel like this needs to be written about, and written about intentionally. So yeah, Amelia really encouraged me to write something on that. And I think with History Matters as well, I think more generally what sort of drew me to their work is that everyone is volunteering their free time, and specifically their free time to uncover Black British histories, which, as we know, they go underserved by our education system. And that's due to a lack of resources, the time that history educators actually have, limitations placed upon like the learning of history by our government. You know, sort of we have histories this country tries to repress. And I think with History Matters, there's this like shared dedication to doing these histories justice, and writing these histories with intention, whilst making them as accessible as possible, whether that's like through our online journal or sort of like sharing them in like different events, like our annual conferences and things. So yeah, I think, yeah, a lot of things drew me to History Matters, but I think it's because people were just using their free time for something that they really cared about. They all they wanted to do was just share it with people. And I really rated that, and I wanted to do the same thing and be a part of it, I guess.
Absolutely. I think as well it speaks to the amount of people that have a passion and a drive to want to do this, like you said, give up their time literally to write about or edit or talk about or put on events, all relating to Black British history. And if we listen to, like, you know, the British government, you'd think that nobody cared and not a single person wanted to know or do this work. But actually, in fact, just like YHP, there are so many young people that care about this work, that care about learning more, that care about educating other people. And it's quite nice when you find like a group of like-minded people that are kind of all on the same mission and willing to do the same thing, essentially. I guess that kind of links into probably why you joined YHP as well. YHP being the Young Historians Project, if anybody has been living under a rock and doesn't know about it.
Come on, people.
Oh yeah, how long have you been in YHP? And again, why did you choose to join it? I'm sure your reasons are kind of similar, but...
Oh God, how long have I been in YHP? Oh my God, I can't even remember, you know. I think it might have been...
Probably not
2020, 2021.
Yeah, I think 2021, or sorry, before 2021, because I joined in 2021 and you were already there. So
so maybe it might have been in the last couple months, maybe, that I was doing my MRes degree.
Yeah.
So I'm pretty sure I've been in YHP for at least 2 years. So I'm going to say 2021.
Yeah.
And I actually joined again because it was kind of similar to with History Matters, because it was around a similar time. I had a couple friends that were already in YHP. My friend Joshua Olocampo, who's a wonderful historian. And, yeah, damn right. Wonderful historian, wonderful archivist. And he was like, yeah, join YHP. And I had, I think this was an earlier chat I had with Professor Addy before I had considered joining History Matters. I had a chat with him and I was like, I really want to carry on sort of contributing to the uncovering of these kinds of histories, but, you know, I don't want it to just be some like self-serving thing. I don't want it to just be like, you know, it has to be a paid day job and I have to do this and I have to do that, you know. I really wanted to sort of, obviously I needed to pay rent. So I was working as well. But I still really wanted to write history. Yeah. And I wanted to write history with people that wanted to write history.
Yeah.
So I joined YHP, I think, particularly because a lot of people were a similar age to me. Obviously, we're all 16 to 25. Everyone's a descendant of the African continent or some of the Caribbean islands. I think some of the young people that are in, well, all of the young people that are in Young Historians are pretty inspiring, to be honest. Like, we literally do have people that who joined when they were 16 and they just, the knowledge that they already had to bring to the table was unbelievable. But I think specifically it was young people that had this knowledge and they knew absolutely that they wanted to share it, which was a key thing. Because I think, like, when you go to like university and that, or if you have these kinds of interests when you're sort of in college and stuff, these sorts of spaces that celebrate history in general can be very cliquey, can be very elitist, not particularly inviting, can be kind of racist. And I was like, I'm not feeling that. No. So yeah, YHP was definitely the place for me, to be honest. And I just ended up like making like sound mates as well, including yourself, my babes.
Love that.
So, yeah, it's been a real joy to sort of be a part of YHP and to see. It's nice because you kind of watch people grow into the historians there.
Yeah, they're going to be. Yeah, definitely.
It's really amazing to see, I think. So yeah,
definitely.
Everyone is, if they're not already a historian, they're on their damn way to doing a damn thing.
Absolutely. So, yeah. And then even the people that like don't necessarily, like they do the history degree or they do the like A-level and whatnot, and then they're like, oh, no, I don't actually want to do that as my like bread and butter, I guess, your 9 to 5, but are still like in it to like contribute to these stories and to do this research. And it's quite remarkable because as I've said, people will try and tell you that this stuff's not interesting. I'm telling you, people are interested. They are interested. Right. They're buying the books. They're listening to the podcasts. Mm-hmm. They're doing the work. It's definitely really cool to see that as well, for sure. So I think you've touched on the chapter you've written in the Many Struggles, New Histories of African and Caribbean People in Britain, which was edited by Hakeem Addy, and it came out July this year. And you have it in my hands right now. If you haven't already bought it, then what are you waiting for? It was published by Pluto Press. You can get it on there. Don't get it on Bezos's website. Get it on Pluto Press or a small independent black bookshop. I think New Beacon Books have it as well. So there's no excuses there, really. But essentially, the book is a collection of chapters, essays, long form essays by quite a few cool people, Hannah being one of them. And they've all written about a variety of topics that kind of relate to the histories of African and Caribbean people in Britain. And I feel like Hannah's chapter, actually, if you're listening to the podcast in order and you listen to last week's episode, which was about my PhD, which is about education, then this follows really well. And I'm really excited that this is happening this way, because now we're talking about education and also the kind of resistance to the racism that was being meted out by the state to black children, especially, and Asian children as well. We separate them now because political blackness isn't a thing. Well, it is. People will try and push it, but it shouldn't be. But they were kind of part of that as well. And I noticed about your chapter, obviously being about the Black Parents Movement, and you've mentioned Jackie Berkeley as well, and about Cliff McDaniel and the campaign, and that's all in there. But I kind of wanted to talk to you first about the archives and maybe the George Padmore Institute, and kind of how you kind of are able to do this work, because we always talk about like people doing the work and talking about the histories, but like how does one do that? And obviously you've got historical training from uni, from your undergrad, from your masters, but where did you kind of start in a sense with this work?
Good question.
Thank you.
So I think I might have said a little earlier on, the chapter was basically a condensed version of my MRes thesis. So a lot of that research was done whilst I was a uni student. So obviously I came across the subject of the Black Parents Movement as a whole during my time studying with Professor Addy. And I'd previously sort of looked at like history, literature and culture, and I wanted to still keep up with exploring themes that I enjoyed within my undergrad. So things like motherhood, community, resistance. And I was just very keen to carry these forward in some way, but in specific relation to Black British history. So I was like looking into Black women's movements, sort of the targeting of Black mothers and their children by police forces, like the case of Cynthia Jarrett, Cherry Gross, sort of in these attempts to exert power over Black people in Britain. And after some very lengthy supervision from Professor Addy, we settled on the Black Parents Movement. And he sort of mentioned, when we were discussing the usefulness of Black-led archives in one of our meetings, and George Padmore Institute was one of these Black-led archives. The George Padmore Institute was actually founded by John LaRose, who, and his late wife, Sarah White, but John LaRose founded the Black Parents Movement as well. So they were massively connected. And he donated all of his papers to the George Padmore Institute to make sure that this history was documented somewhere. So I did, I visited the archive. I literally just Googled them on their website, got in contact and said, I'm really interested in this subject. I think I'm struggling to know where to start. And I figured out I kind of wanted to round it down to, because there is so much history with the Black Parents Movement, you know. Like my chapter in particular focuses specifically on its founding in London and its expansion in Manchester. Manchester was where one of the biggest sections of the Black Parents Movement was in the country. But that being said, they also had one of the largest sections in Bradford, which worked in conjunction massively with the Asian Students Movement. So I visited the archive and I spoke with their archivist, Sarah Garrod, who was an absolute joy. She helped me sort of sift down the kinds of collections that I wanted to look at, because I was really keen on looking at its founding history and how the organization worked and then its key campaigns. So she really, really helped me with that kind of structure. And actually, I visited there a couple of times over the sort of summer I was doing the main bulk of the research. And it was just before Sarah White actually passed, but I bumped into her. I was the only researcher there at the time. And she came upstairs. She was in her 90s, you know. She came all the way up them downstairs.
Those stairs are treacherous.
I've always broken the ankle myself. I'm only 24. But she came upstairs and she lit up the room and she was just so full of knowledge about the BPM. And she was very aware of the fact of her positionality of being a white woman. But she had done so much work to support John LaRose, not only John LaRose, but the black community in general. And she was just, she was so, so helpful. Like, she was calling people on her phone that were in the Black Parents Movement and letting me have conversations with them. Like, she was such a joy. And I think I was doing this during COVID. Like, I couldn't go to any university libraries. I couldn't get, there's this little thing called a SCONAL access card. So where you go to all the uni libraries, like, wherever. Couldn't even register for one of them in 2020, man. Like, I was like, oh my God, how am I going to do this? Really, really was the people that support, found, work at Black-led or more socialist-leaning archives that were just, that really, really helped me through that. Obviously, alongside Professor Addy's supervision, it was people like that in places like that, in those Black-led archives, that really, really got my work to where I wanted it to be, you know? And it's not just my work. This is just, I'm just writing about the work of the people that laid the foundations for this kind of stuff, you know? So, yeah, working with the archives was amazing. Shout out Sarah White. Shout out Sarah Garrod. Shout out Roxy Harris, who had a nice phone conversation with me. And also, like, I accessed a couple tapes from, like, the Black Cultural Archives as well, which is obviously one of... the sort of most well-known Black-led archives here in Britain. And Rhoda Boateng, she sent me some recordings. She sent me scannings of some documents and things when I couldn't go in and access this. Like, people were so flexible and willing to help. It, again, like, sort of writing something like this became a collectivist activity in a way.
I had the same, literally same experience. Shout out Rhoda. She saved my whole master's because, because how were uni libraries like, no, we're not opening, fine, it is lockdown. But like, it was literally those are set, literally sending, manning their emails and sending me, as you said, transcripts, oral history recordings. I went to George Padmore. I think I went in like, maybe like November or like, just that window where things opened up a little bit, but only one, like you said, only one person could be in the room at a time. And like, you had to wear a mask all day long. Literally, like, if it wasn't for that, like, and the unis weren't exactly, what's the word? They weren't really accommodating, I'll say, of deadlines and everything. People, we need to talk about this more. I know there's like campaign, students are doing a campaign against universities for like loss of time during COVID, but they also need to talk about like the fact that they were so unrelenting with deadlines. It's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. I don't want to take us off topic, but you mentioned a really important point there. Like, the writing of these histories is not just done in a vacuum. It's not just one person that does all the work. It is, as you said, a collective kind of exercise. It is the archives. It is the support from people like Professor Hakeem supervising the work. It is the willingness of them to go above and beyond and go from their own knowledge and take out all the things that they know and like pour that into you as well, and for then you to be able to do that work. So defo shout out all those people and their continued work, you know, even beyond COVID and whatnot.
Yeah, man. I think just sort of, if I'm allowed to like
go in, girl.
I think what you said about Professor Addy as well, like you're right in that universities in general were unrelenting with deadlines. Like, and I personally really struggled.
Yep.
So I'm not gonna lie, mental health was absolutely in the bin at that time as well.
Bottom of the bin.
Oh, mate, it sucked. And a lot of people can share that experience, right?
Yeah.
But Professor Addy, not the university, Professor Addy was the one who was like, okay, what kind of support do you need? Yeah. What kind of support actually works for you? I'm not talking about, you know, necessarily going through university formalities, but what's going to work for you right now? So we ended up having weekly meetings just to check in, just to see how much I had written that day, figure out strategies to get me motivated again, to get me in a more positive mindset. It was a really tough time, obviously, during COVID. Just not credit to universities, credit to the people that make university experience bearable. And that is people like Professor Addy. That is people that work in community archives, in independent Black-led archives. So, yeah, just big up all of those people.
Absolutely. And it's like a natural kind of progression to this point. I didn't plan to talk about it, but with the situation with the literal masters that you did and Professor Addy's role now being made redundant, and literally you're a testament to that work, to that course, to everything that was that he had put into founding that course and then running it. And it's quite interesting, well, when I interviewed him on this podcast about it, I didn't realize that the course had always been online. For you, I guess, well, for me, when I was doing my master's and it was like 2020 March and they were literally like, go home, libraries closed, uni's closed, everything's now online. The first like 3 or 4 seminars online were literally just, everyone was just panicking. Like, can we hear you? Does the tech work? Like, you guys were doing that. You were there. Worldwide, international cohort.
International. I'm talking like Hong Kong, Canada.
Yeah.
All across the UK. I think one of our students was visiting family in the African continent at one point as well.
Yeah.
But still, like, because we had all of that set up, because it was originally an online course for distance learners, for people who may not have had a traditional route into education. So, you know, it wasn't a course just made for middle class people that were interested in history and wanted to write something. Like, this was a very, very intentional course for people of Black descent to be able to access these kinds of histories, be able to write about them, be able to share them and document it. So it just, the course was organized just so, so well. And so in COVID, it was a nightmare still, because obviously universities were not golden during COVID whatsoever, and especially the University of Chichester.
Are we surprised?
No, we are not. However, the way in which Hakeem had almost designed that programme was to allow for flexibility for people that might have childcare needs, for people that might not have had all the money to be able to do I don't know, like an MA in Black history in the heart of London, where it's going to cost you like 12 grand minimum.
Yep.
Do you know what I'm saying? Like, you know, it's a very, very intentional setup in terms of that course. And it's just devastating that it's been axed. It's absolutely devastating. I'm really hoping that, I mean, I'm not entirely sure what the plans are, but it would just be wonderful. Like, I don't know if another institution can pick it up.
Yeah.
You know, the campaign group are keeping it strong, you know, the message strong, and I'm really glad that they are. But it's, yeah, it's an absolute travesty that's been axed.
Absolutely. And if you are listening and you do want to further find out about that, there was an episode I did, I think it's number 113, but also visit the website. The History Matters website have a section of the page that's dedicated to that. There's also an MRES, like Save the MRES campaign. You can find them on Twitter as well as a website as well. I'll leave all of those details in the show notes so you can, you know, look at that at your own, at your own leisure. That's the one. At your own leisure and find out what's going on there, because as it's been made very clear, like, there are, this history is popular, and don't let society and these universities and institutions tell you or convince you that they're not. They absolutely are, and they're not only are they popular, they're also extremely important. And it's shocking to me that we're moving in the direction of having less of these departments, like Goldsmiths and these masters and these modules and these courses. There's so many institutions moving away instead of moving towards them. I thought we were supposed to be getting more progressive as society and time goes on, and it's just going backwards to me. But we won't dwell too much on that at this point, but please do go onto the show notes and find out more about that if you haven't already kind of educated yourself on what's happening there. Back to your chapter, because I don't want to kind of finish that just yet. We spoke about the archives and kind of how you were able to do this work. For anyone that hasn't read the chapter yet, what was your kind of favourite thing to not uncover? But I always feel like historian work is a little bit like detective work. You're kind of like finding the stories in the archives and then, you know, you're writing them out and explaining them to people. Kind of what was your like most maybe significant thing that you kind of found or wanted, the message you would want to get across from that chapter and that work that you did on the Black Parents Movement?
Oh, good question, man.
Thank you.
I think before getting into the archives and really, you know, getting into sort of like the nitty gritty of it all, I didn't realise how interconnected and active sort of parent student organizations were and how strong that collaboration was at that time. And I think it was just so inspiring, to be honest, to see that. I mean, with Cliff McDaniel, for example, you know, he was beaten, falsely arrested by police just outside of his school, just because him and his two mates, the three of them were young Black boys in their school uniform on their lunch break, literally just chilling, walking down the road. Police completely targeted them, picked on them. They were racist. And sort of, so Cliff McDaniel, he was known to a supplementary school in the area in North London. I believe it was actually, which supplementary school was it? I think it was the George Padmore Supplementary School, which is where John LaRose also sort of helped out too. He was one of the key teachers and founders. And, you know, a lot of young people caught wind of what was going on. Actually, one of the young people with Cliff McDaniel was one of LaRose's sons. And obviously, LaRose and a lot of his sort of friends here were very politically active in Black organisations. And a lot of these kids were like, this is mental. Like, how is this happening still? And I'm talking like this is in the 70s too. And this has been going on for a very, very long time already in Britain. And just that sort of coming together, I think, of young people and their elders is something that I feel like maybe I lacked growing up. I think maybe a lot of like young Black and young Black mixed race people might have lacked growing up as well, is knowing that we actually do have these connections with our elders. And I think often these connections are in very, very recent history. And I think there's so many, I think especially in like this post 2020 arena of anti-racism, and it's very much been taken over by, you know, in terms of like, I suppose this is true globally as well, but I think on British soil, it's just been taken over by corporations. You know, it's all very tick box, EDI here, anti-racist charter there, but do we stick to it? No, we do not. Herman Chichester University. But just sort of in this sort of post 2020 arena that we're in at the moment, I think, yeah, we could just really benefit from like actually still putting these practices into place of young people and elders working together. And people are still doing that these days as well. We just feel like we can't see it because our state is trying so hard to crack down on it. Elders in our community that are organizing and young people in our community that are organizing as well. They're really trying to crack down on it. So with this chapter, my message is we got to revive it, man.
We need
to revive some kind of parent-student or elder young people collaboration. Absolutely. And I think it is definitely still present in Britain. Absolutely. There are people still putting in that work. But it needs to be sort of on a national scale seen by all of us, you know? And I think when I went to the archives and I read through handwritten papers, things that are written on typewriters, like some of their meeting minutes and stuff, like this sense of community and love that was shared in, you know, centering, you know, the interests of Black people and advancing those interests as well. I think it was just so strong between parents and their children.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, I think it's something that we need to be seeing and we need to have more access to know that actually this does work. These methods do work. Our state might be cracking down on us, but these methods do work. We have to work together, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
So yeah, it's a bit waffly.
No, I completely get the point. And I was thinking, you mentioned as well about the way activism is today. It's very commercial. I also find it's very, like, it's very much tied into consumerism as well. And I was thinking also a lot of the activism that we do, if we can call it that, is done online. And I think this is where the break with the generations comes, because the kind of activism our grandparents' generation or even our parents' generation is not on Instagram, it's not on TikTok. They aren't accessing that, and we aren't coming off our screens long enough in some cases. So we've kind of got to, and we have to find a platform essentially that works for both generations or across generations, which will not be online. And until we kind of realize that, I think we've got to do more than black squares on a day in June in 2020, then we won't really get much further. Like with the situation with that Asian hair shop owner in Peckham, you know, people got onto the streets. They're outside that shop. That man's shop hasn't been open since, I don't think. Like that's the kind of activism we need to see more of. And I think, unfortunately, like we saw with George Floyd, it's not until things get really bad and really dire that people come outside. But I think we need to come outside for less, which is also very scary and a difficult thing when the police is such a racist institution and it is such a risk on ourselves, on our lives, to step outside and be in these spaces sometimes. But yeah, lots to think about, but an interesting point. And I think drawing from the lessons of the past is something that I took from your chapter as well. Like there are so many important lessons in the way that things were done back then that we can still do now, because this is in living memory. Most people, our parents' generation, they were definitely alive then. They were there.
I mean.
They've got the recipes.
We're saying it's history, and it is.
Yeah.
But, you know, it weren't that long ago.
Nope.
You know, and history is still being made today. Absolutely. You know, there are people organising. We're not seeing it, man. Seeing it. There's scary legislation coming into play. We can't protest in particular ways. Yep. We can't be present in particular ways. It's more of a risk for people who may not be a UK national. It's more of a risk for people who do not have the funds to be able to get legal support if they do run into the police and are hurt or subjected to the criminal justice system. You know, darker skinned black people, it should not be on them to be present all the time at these protests when they are more likely to be the ones who are subjected to specifically that kind of violence from police.
Absolutely.
I think there needs to be a reflection on people's positionality. And I do kind of agree with you in terms of, like, you know, sometimes we do need to get off the screens. But also, I think there is a sense of, like, you know, there's a lot of organising going on still. And sometimes we just need to bridge that gap between generations and just come together. And, like, there is so much that our families, our elders, you know, like, real figures in the sort of black community, us younger people. And there probably is something that younger people could bring to our elders as well. And I think, you know, we need to be given the space to be able to share that. And I think living somewhere like Britain, it's actually becoming increasingly more difficult to be able to establish those places, which again, the state tries to keep under wraps, but they're really, really trying to take out these spaces one by one, yeah, you know?
Absolutely.
Exactly how they did it in the 70s. Targeting shebeens, targeting restaurants, targeting youth clubs, you know?
Yep.
It's exactly the same tactics.
Same tactics, different day. Indeed, mm-hmm. It is. Right, Hannah. Thank you so much for sharing so much of your work and about yourself on this episode. It's been a pleasure. I knew it was going to be great. I knew it, and it has been. So I'm so, so happy. And thank you for making the time to be on the podcast today. I was thinking whenever like I have a guest on, I'm like, oh, I don't know what I'm going to title the podcast, but I never really ask what I'm going to ask you. And I just jotted down, I think, Black Parents Movement and Intergenerational Activism. Featuring Hannah Francis, that might be the title. If you're listening and this is a title, then Hannah liked it. If not, then she didn't, and we'll have a different title. But I think it's an important message, I think, to go with if you are listening. And we've mentioned so many ways and so many causes today that probably need some activism, some activists. So you know, be inspired by the work that's been done and that will continue to be done if you aren't already feeling that. Do you have any parting words, Hannah? Do you have anything you'd like to leave us with? Or if you want to share your socials or anything like that, or any of the organisations that you're in, just to plug and support, then please take the time to do that now.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm going to plug History Matters Journal.
Nice.
You can find us at historymatters.online/journal. We're always taking submissions for things. Our email's on there, histmatters@gmail.com, histmatters@gmail.com. So yeah, hit us up if you've got anything interesting to submit on Black history, Black British history. Oh gosh, what else? Yeah, I've been off work recently and sort of researching on and off, trying to get back into the game from this week.
Nice.
So, you know, you can hit me up on Insta, at @silly_ebadu if you know me, or if you're interested in like getting to know me, or nice, like working on anything cool. Yeah, man. And just yeah, support History Matters, support young historians, support members of your community. And yeah, just big up to Deanna as well for this wonderful podcast. I've been listening for quite some time.
Thank you.
And I'm actually like really, really honoured you asked me to be on this. So yeah, just thank you so much for having me, and for like platforming a lot of us and a lot of these histories. So yeah, you're doing a sick job, man.
Thank you. Thanks, Hannah. Oh, gosh, make me shy. Right. All of the things that Hannah just said is also going to be in the show notes. So if you missed any of that, then it'll be there as well. But thank you so much for joining me, and everyone that is listening, have a wonderful week. Goodbye.